to startuprad.io, your podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Joe from startupray.io, your startup podcast and YouTube blog from Germany, as well as the world's first internet radio station dedicated to startups and tech companies. Today, I do have another interview in our partnership series with Munich Startups. I would like to welcome Heidi now in the person of Andreas. Hey, Andreas, how are you doing?
Hi, Joe. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's totally my pleasure. And we may tell our audience that this is almost a running gag because we've been talking about this interview since, I do believe, January. And you always said, there's something upcoming. There's another thing upcoming. And it turns out it was your acquisition of AridNext, which was announced this week. We're recording this on July 1st. And this will be published pretty soon. And we're the first, outlet you ever talked to about it. Really excited about that. And let's get ready. So I've been looking at your LinkedIn profile, as many other people do. And I realized you studied in Munich and then you went on to work with Bertelsmann, which would mean nothing for people living outside of Germany, but they may know one of the properties, the BMG music label, Bertelsmann Music Group, which is one of the very large music labels globally. What did you do there and how did you like it? Because I've seen you work directly for the CEO there.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very interesting subject, right? Bertelsmann, as you rightly said, will probably not tell people too much, people outside Germany. They're known typically for their media brands like BMG. For people in the startup world or scale-up world, they will also recognize probably their investment activities. There's a large Bertelsmann fund out there that's investing later stage, growth stage. When I joined, this was like the early days of the internet. It was in 1999. At the time, Bertelsmann was actually quite active with AOL in the US. They brought AOL Europe to Europe together. And there were, I think at the time, a few hundred ventures that Bertelsmann had founded over a period of a few years. I was working in one of these ventures. I was actually not working with the then CEO. I was working in one of these ventures and with the CEO of that venture. The venture was called MediaWays. And it was an infrastructure provider, so B2B business, again, I shall say, a B2B business providing internet infrastructure to media companies, digital media companies mainly. Services included at the time internet access. So it was still the days when Boris Becker was actually proud to be online, right? Connecting to the internet at that in these days was something that people got excited about. We provided hosting services to a number of digital players, and over time then developed the portfolio from basic narrowband internet to broadband, voice over IP services, and ended up building one of the largest wholesale platforms in Germany for broadband access and voice over IP services.
I vividly remember this time because there have been a lot of AOL CDs around where you could install the software and then you had to have this dial-up connection really went through the phone line. And then when it quieted down, you actually had a connection and it was so incredibly slow compared to today. But it was also my personal first access to the internet. So I think I still have one or two AOL CDs around here. I assume this was an exciting time, but nonetheless, you left to co-found a startup in Berlin and San Francisco. And let us talk a little bit more about this, because that startup is called Fiber. It's helping app businesses to grow revenue, they say, and it's still around. So let's talk just a little bit more about them. What did actually drive you to go from the CEO of Telefonica here in Germany, which was an intermediate step to start a startup? What was driving you there?
I was actually I was leading the German fixed net activities of Telefonica for a couple of years, and then we ended up rolling the fixed net business into O2 as part of a larger deal of the Telefonica group level. And from my personal taste, it was a great time. It was super exciting, a very steep learning curve over a couple of years, but it also at the end got probably too corporate for me. I want to, prefer to be back to something more entrepreneurial. And then spent a couple of months working on different ideas and got in touch with a group of entrepreneurs from Berlin, Team Europe at the time. And then we looked at together at a few opportunities, and fiber emerged as one of let's say the most appealing ones. So between Janis Zech, Jan Beckers, and myself, we co-founded the company, kicked it off. In the beginning as an ed tech company focused on the European market, then quickly realized that actually 70% of the market volume is in the US. So with a pure European focus, we would have been, let's say, irrelevant by definition. So after 1 year, we already started branching out into the US, built the business there, and after 2 years, already had a company that was active in, I think, 20 markets, including the US. Scaled the business from there, and I think later, 2013, I also went to the US, spent, let's say, the second half of my tenure at Fiber in San Francisco, running the US side of the business. Sold it in 2014, and then for the new owners, still did quite a bit of M&A activity. And if you look at Fiber today, I think they just signed a deal a couple of months ago, acquisition by Digital Turbine, now valued at $600 million. So the business has grown to substantial scale, as you have in the edtech space. It's a market for a few players of very critical scale. So great for them to still be around. And I'm very happy and proud that the company still exists and prospers.
When you're in San Francisco, do you still stop by for coffee?
Yeah, absolutely. Not that often, obviously, in the last 18 months, given everything that's going on in the world. But yeah, of course, when I'm there, I definitely would stop by and say hello. I actually just checked a few weeks ago, and many of my colleagues from the days are still around.
Mm-hmm. I've also seen that you are a board partner of Point Nine Capital, which is a venture capital fund here. I was wondering, first, what is a board partner, and secondly, what do you do with those guys?
So Point Nine is known as one of the leading early stage funds in Europe. The strong focus on marketplaces and SaaS, but also, let's say, some outliers here and there. I go back with Pavel and Christoph almost 10 years now, more than 10 years actually. They're structured in a way that they have the core team, the investment team, as every fund has. They have quite an impressive number of companies they've invested in, and they're looking for support on two sides of the business. One, the venture, the deal origination side, so new deal, bringing new deals to the fund, and then also on the other side of the business, where when you're invested, company is developing and tracking over time, but you need people to work with the founders, with the management team, help them to maneuver day to day challenges, scaling the organization, preparing and taking strategic decisions. That's where I'm playing a role. I'm not so much on the origination side. I'm working with existing portfolio companies, helping, coaching the founders where appropriate, also taking board seats and board roles when there's a good fit. And it's actually quite exciting job because it's a nice counter balance to the day-to-day CEO job, where you're responsible for all the operations. Very nice to work with entrepreneurs and just provide them with the advice and additional views on their businesses.
When you've been talking about that, I was wondering how you arrange all those responsibilities, because everybody can tell to lead a company is already quite exhausting. And then you add another layer of duties on top of that. How do you manage your time that you can actually achieve both to a satisfying degree?
So from a very practical point of view, several of my companies I work with on the 0.9 side are based in the US or in Canada. So by definition, these calls are in the evenings. It makes it easier. Then also from, you know, if you just look at it from a time commitment as a board partner, as I said, I'm not responsible for the business. I'm not spending hours and hours a week on individual companies. So I have my check-ins with the founders. They reach out to me when they have specific topics to discuss, and we spend a little bit more time. I attend the board meetings. Typically, try to arrange them outside my schedule here at ID Now. It's something that I enjoy doing, right? I mean, it's not something I have to give up my free time in doing. I enjoy working with entrepreneurs. I enjoy working with young startups. So it's a good almost a pastime.
I see. I would like to add that a lot of young entrepreneurs and even older entrepreneurs really profit from coaching. When I look back in what I tried in my first business venture, it's now forehead slapping stupid. And I wish I had somebody back in the days to who would have told me about that. So don't discard any advice instantly, guys. And you're personally active with Scala Ventures. I assume it's your own investment vehicle.
Yeah, it's my own investment vehicle. I've started doing angel investments in 2010, in the early days of Fiber. Been more regular investor, a more active investor since 2014. But the most active, certainly after my days at Fiverr, this is something I'm very selective these days, simply because I don't have the time to really look at deals in detail. When I look at stuff, it's typically ideas, topics, teams that are somehow in my wheelhouse. I'm trying to be very selective. FinTech is one of them, I would say. RegTech is certainly another one where I'm close and I feel like I can contribute immediately. I also have some unfair advantage in the sense that I know the industry a little bit better, right? But I don't look at let's say all opportunities in full breadth, simply because I don't have the time. Yeah, the board partner role can be fitted in quite nicely and neatly into the day-to-day schedule, but the angel investments, I need to be very selective these days.
I see. People may already wondering, hey guys, you're now talking for more than 10 minutes and we didn't touch ID Now yet, but this is the point, we can't do it. You are a rarity here on the channel because you are the CEO of a startup. This is not rare by itself, but you are not of the founders. How did this happen, and why did you take the job? Can you take us a little bit through the journey, how you got hired for ID Now?
I'm actually an angel investor. I have been an angel investor in ID Now since 2014. So I've followed the company for several years before I joined as a CEO. I also go back with Felix and some of the founders for almost 10 years now. Felix has been an early investor in Fiber. So this is how we established the initial connection. And then after my return from the US, I ended up working with Felix and the board on an accelerated growth strategy at the time as an advisor, really. Kind of for whatever reason, the board felt like this might be a good idea if we embark this journey together. And then the conversations developed from there. Quite frankly, before we started the conversation, I was, I'm not going to take an operational role as a CEO again. then we had the conversations. I really liked the team. I liked the opportunity. I'm excited about the topic of digital identities, the potential that this has for changing you know, user behavior, user market convenience, but also just you know, making the connected world a safer place, as one of our key statements here at ID Now. So things came together, and within 4 weeks we were like, yeah, okay, this it's an exciting plan, it's an exciting space, it's potentially a good fit. And given the fact that I'm still around to more than 2 years later, it probably wasn't too bad. So a lot of good stuff happening, and I'm enjoying the ride.
Yeah, I think so, especially those challenging times during Corona. But I would assume, since we already had one of your competitors in the interview, they told us about an uptick in activity because everything, almost everything, had to be done remotely, which I do believe was also a boost to the business of ID Now. But can you take us a little bit around the founding story and how the company developed until your two acquisitions this year?
ID Now was founded around, let's say, when for the first time a digital onboarding process was allowed under German regulation, allowed by BaFin. At the time, the product was called Videodent. So it was the first time that you, as a bank, as a financial services institution, you could verify the identity of a user remotely. And that's how the company was starting. It was really, at the time, a point solution. And there was only one product that would be, you know, let's say, would have been approved by BaFin, which was a Videodent product. And there are very few companies in the German market who would provide that service, that product. And that's how ID Now grew over a couple of years, with a very strong focus on financial services, because financial services would have been at the center of anti-money laundering regulation. And then over the years, with, let's say, digital identity or identity verification becoming more ubiquitous. Also, you know, when we sat down in 2018, late 2018, and discussing accelerated growth strategy, we looked at how can we take this further, right? And how can we take this further is, number one, build something more automated than Videodent at the time and get that approved by regulators in Germany and elsewhere. Secondly, look at, you know, if in particular where elsewhere means like other geographies, so other countries in other jurisdictions in which we can sell our services. So we started building out a UK team. We have now a small team in Middle East. We are doing actually quite a bit of business in Central Eastern Europe. And now with the recent acquisition also, you know, we have a presence in France. And from there, I would expect us to take also a step at the Spanish market. The third piece was product. The automated product was the first derivative, really, of the Videodent product that has taken the company so far. But if you look at identity verification needs today, then really our customers don't necessarily ask us for a Videodent or a AutoIdent product anymore. They have a certain set of needs in the with regards to identity verification, and they're looking for a partner who caters to these needs, you know, as a platform, and not so much as a point solution for Videodent or a point solution for EID. So today, what ID Now is offering is the whole suite of products, you know, from Videodent to AutoIdent to EID to Bankident in the coming months. So all of that coming from a single platform, single API, and as an enterprise customer, I'm just integrating with the service, and then I can pick and choose which products to use, you know, depending on the use case, depending on the jurisdiction.
We may put this a little bit in perspective, what we just been talking about, because I vividly remember when I was registering online for my first online brokerage account in the early, in the late 1990s during the dot-com boom there. You had basically to get a paper-based letter from the online bank. You had to go to the post office at the counter, show your ID. They would fill it out, put official stamps on it, and then put it in the envelope and straight send it to the online bank. And that was the only way you could, for quite some time, validly open in Germany online accounts of any way. So that was basically at one point the technicality of it, and then online identification started. I do believe there were some questions at the beginning, and the, you said BaFin, it's the oversight body in Germany, was not too happy with online identification, but at one point they just had to move with the time, and they were satisfied with what was offered. And ever since, you can make identifications online. I do believe it was quite good that it could do online identifications in the time of Corona to really minimize the contacts there. And, as you said, basically, a customer approaches you and says, okay, I got trouble with the identification, or I need identification. Can you do that for me? And basically you say yes across all channels.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much like you said, if you look back 20 years, it took days to get your identity verified. With Videodent, it was down to 10 minutes. And with the new product, you know, depending on the level of approval, you're down to half a minute, or sometimes even just seconds. And I think that's a huge benefit for the user. But it's also most importantly for the enterprise customer, who typically would have to foot the bill for the verification. You know, it lowers the cost significantly, and it improves the conversion rate, because the user would have to wait for a couple of days for the letter to make it to the bank. There's a risk of them just not completing the process. If they have to wait for the video ident call, or spend 10 minutes in a call, higher risk of just dropping out from the call. If it's working like a charm in 30 seconds, you would expect the highest conversion rates. And I think that's where the industry is headed. That's where we're headed. And we're happy to lead the charge here.
Yes. And just adding to what you said, taking days, sometimes it could take weeks, because you had to arrange your personal schedule with the opening hours of the local post office, which may or may not have been pretty good, because I remember from the place where I grew up, basically they were only open at one or two times in the afternoon, because the person working there was also tasked to bring all the letters to the recipient. So basically he was on his mailing route almost throughout the day, and then two days in the week in the afternoon, he or she could make office hours. So I remember it took quite some time until I could arrange myself. But we're now in the technological world. And I've did some research, and amongst your clients, there's some companies our audience may know, like N26, Sixt, the car rental company, Western Union, most people will know it, Solaris Bank, we frequently talk about them in our startup news, WeFox, Tier Mobility. So actually, I'm a client of Tier Mobility, so I used your identification solution without noticing it, right?
Yes.
Okay. And Commerzbank, which is a large commercial bank here in Germany. And you already have some big clients there, but nonetheless, you started acquisitions. Ariad Next is your second acquisition this year already, and it's a French online ID company. Amongst its clients, they have Société Générale. It's a large bank in France, and United Credit. This is already your second acquisition this year. And my understanding is you get the money from a PE player, private equity player, Corsair. And do you think this is the way forward for companies in Europe, for tech companies, first to get the money to acquire competitors and build critical mass, instead going for an IPO as fast as possible?
Oh, that's a number of questions in one question. So
yes, I like to do that.
to start with, so the acquisition of Ariad Next and Identity TM, there were actually two very different transactions. if I go back to what I said earlier, there were like three dimensions of growth that we had identified for ID Now in 2019: geo, vertical, and product. And the identity TM transaction was really doubling down here in Germany on the vertical dimension. So we've been strong in financial services, we're strong in mobility, we're strong in a few other sectors, including sports betting. Identity TM has had a strong heritage in the telco market. So we're adding telco as an important vertical here to ID Now Group. Ariadnext is slightly different. Ariadnext has, if you look at the industries, the vertical markets that they go after, they're like literally 90% the same than what we do. Yeah. So the case was really they're strong in the French market. Typically, the business that we are in is a business that is strongly influenced by domestic regulation still, certainly in the anti-money laundering environment. And hard to break into a market as a new entrant coming from a different jurisdiction. So there it was number one about the geographical market of France. And secondly, given the structure and the level of maturity of the French market, the ecosystem there had developed slightly differently. So what they're offering is a fully automated product suite. Banks are still providing part of the services that in Germany we would do as ID Now, banks do themselves in France. So what we ended up with is number one, a strong footprint in France, but also secondly, a product suite that's highly complementing what we have developed for the German market. So it's slightly different. In both cases, what's very similar is we keep the entrepreneurs on board and keep them motivated and engaged in the combined company. Try to combine their entrepreneurial spirit with let's say some safe pairs of hands that we've brought in on the ID Now side, and together develop a business that has the potential to be the market leader in Europe. So to your question, is that the new strategy or the dominant strategy versus heading for an IPO directly? I would argue it's not the one or the other, right? If you're in the food delivery business, you can well build your business organically. Even though if you look at Delivery Hero, they've also done a lot of M&A on the way. But maybe as a fintech, you can build your own business and still head towards the fastest possible IPO. Our market is slightly different. It's very fragmented. It's very much influenced and sometimes even driven by regulation. Regulation is different market by market. And in a way, it's also different vertical market by vertical market. So M&A can be a means to an end in that regard. So I don't think we're going to focus exclusively on M&A as a way to grow the business going forward. We're growing organically 50, 60% year over year right now. So M&A is kind of supplementing that growth. We're adding new geographies, new product features, but our predominant way of growing going forward will be organically, and then we sprinkle in the occasional M&A when it happens. Can it be a good strategy? I think it can. There's a number of players out there who've demonstrated that. But I think it's important that you don't only focus on M&A, but you have also healthy business underneath that's growing year over year over year.
We may add, for the people who have never been in a post-merger integration, that can basically make you lose all your hair because you have different teams, different culture, plus in best cases, completely different IT infrastructure. So you have to make a lot of decisions to actually end up sometimes a few years, sometimes even decades later with one unified company if you do the right steps along the way. And there's a lot of very large mergers that just basically went wrong. I assume you already had a plan how to integrate Ariadnext and Identity TM in your infrastructure, in your processes before you actually bought them, right?
I would describe it as we have a plan, and I'd say we with Identity TM, we're now 4 months into the integration. We just discussed last night that we actually aim to conclude most of the integration work streams and efforts by the end of this year. So we're not talking decades here. We're talking less than a year as a goal. There will still be some parts of the infrastructure that will probably continue to run for a while, but there I would think that we're on a pretty good track. It's also somewhat a more natural fit because we're both in the same geographic market. We're addressing similar verticals and working with a similar products. In France, it's definitely going to be slightly different. There's more cultural difference. There is a perception of ArriadNext in the market. So we have a plan there as well to integrate the two companies. We have already defined the roles and responsibilities also for their founders. So that's all happening. We have a pretty good understanding of the product, the client base, and have a vision for the joint product portfolio. But the really detailed post-merger integration plan will only be put together, let's say, now in the coming weeks and months after the closing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think going back to my earlier one, just a small comment on that. Going back to my earlier point, that's why it's important for us to buy businesses that are healthy and growing organically. We're certainly not going to wait for decades for the integration, but whether we kick off the integration next month or a month later really shouldn't make that much of a difference, for as long as the underlying business is healthy, the right people are still in charge and growing that business, and then we can take a focused but not a rushed approach towards integration.
Mm-hmm. I think there your business is a little bit different from where I've been working in financial services and post-merger integrations, because there the infrastructure, all the IT, it really costs a hell of a lot of money. But if ArriadNext is profitable by itself, I do understand that you can keep them running quite for a bit. You already talked a lot about the question I would like to ask now, the strategy behind the business. So you talked about verticals, that means industries, for example, gambling, financial services, healthcare services online, yada, 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 and the other geography, which just means countries. Yeah. As you said, everything is regulated on a national level. For some financial services stuff, it's regulated across Europe, but never ever forget the taxes. they can really throw a stone or two in your cogwheels. But the question I had was, you kind of circumvented it a little bit, if this would be a valid strategy for many European startups you see out there, first to do a little bit M&A activity across Europe before they really go into the global market. Totally understanding here that your business is nationally regulated, and basically there's not like a big incentive, like building platform like many international players are doing it, because you would not be able to use it in many different countries at the same time in exactly the right setup.
I think it can be a valid strategy. Absolutely, yes. But as with organic growth and product-led growth, it needs to be executed well. Right? It's not something you do the one or the other, and you know, the M&A is the easier way. I mean, M&A is about post-merger integration, but M&A is also about, you know, even getting a deal to bringing a deal to a level where you can potentially close it, get the financing for it, need to get the pricing right, need to provide the right incentive. So it's about execution. If in certain industries, I think it can be a fast track to growth, and potential IPO can be one outcome. But at the end, IPO is also, you know, another transaction, whether that's a trade sale or an IPO or another financing round, it's one step along the way of the company. And the question is, how do you get on the growth trajectory? And if you can grow organically, it's probably easier from a change management point of view. In certain industries, it can make totally sense to to bring together a number of assets and build one player of critical scale, and by doing so also putting some distance between you as an industry leader and some of the rest of the market.
Mm-hmm. Talking about IPO, I vividly remember the German business newspaper Handelsblatt talking about entrepreneurs being flooded with SPAC offers. Does it also hold true for you? You guys get like regular calls. Hey, this is an investment bank XY. Are you interested to be acquired by a SPAC?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we're in that market. We're one of the companies of let's say reasonable scale, which is required to make the SPAC transaction successful. So definitely, we get inbound interest. For us right now, we have a shareholder structure that allows us to do what we're doing well. I think beyond that, there's nothing I can share here other than yes, there's inbound interest and the market for SPACs has been around for a while. It's probably never been hotter than in the last 12 months. So definitely an interesting one to watch and an interesting way of getting to a public listing. But nothing more to say, you know, from the IDNR perspective at this point.
Translates for our audience into you get SPACs calls, but you don't tell everybody, just disappear. Basically, you're still evaluating the options. Okay, I get that. We are already running a little bit longer than our normal interviews, which I usually do with more experienced entrepreneurs because we have a lot to talk about. But getting now a little bit to the end of our interview, I would like to ask you one question. What would be the key takeaways a listener or viewer should take away from our interview here?
That's a very good question, right? And depending obviously on the audience, I think as you know, typically what I would expect most of the audience here to look at is younger stage companies. I think what you can take away is can the entrepreneurial journey can still be quite exciting when you're running a scale up. ID Now is now 8 years old. Fiber, when I founded it, co-founded it in 2009, now is 12 years old and still growing fast and tracking. So I think it is really down to the entrepreneur to grow with the business, never stop learning, never stop aspiring. Enjoy the ride while it lasts, and it's a never settle for the let's say the short term outcome, and rather if you have a vision, continue to build the business and grow the business because it remains exciting over time, even though it's tiring typically for an entrepreneur and founder. But over time, you know, the challenges get a lot more exciting, and the outcome, the impact that you have on society is very different. So that's I'd say the one advice that I would give to entrepreneurs that are listening here to this podcast.
I see. So only thing left for me is saying thank you very much for the interview. It was a pleasure having you as guest, and everybody who would like to learn more, they can go down here in the show notes. There's a link to your LinkedIn profile as well as to the company's website.
Thank you very much for having me, Joel. And thank you to the audience for listening.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you are a professional looking at the European startup scene, Germany is a place you cannot miss. Fortunately for you, there is startuprad.eu, the authority on German startups. This English-only podcast brings you fresh interviews each week. Most likely, you have never heard or read anything on these startups before in English, but you will in the future. Be ahead of the curve and subscribe to startuprad.eu podcast. Or check for the startuprad.eu internet radio station. Check your Alexa for the startuprad.eu skill as well.